Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we begin, I'd like to open with a prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless this conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. Today, I'm very excited to introduce you to one of our 2026 Herbert J. Storing Prize nominees, Dr. Brooke Barbier. Brooke is a public historian who received her PhD in American history from Boston College, researching Boston's social and cultural life during and after the American Revolution. While earning her graduate degree, she taught history at Boston College and Stonehill College. And in the most Ciceronian Society-ish thing ever, two of Brooke's favorite things are history and beer. That could not be more relatable. But those two interests are not just hobbies. They are literally her job. In 2013, she founded Ye Old Tavern Tours, which offers tours of Boston's historic sites and taverns, beer is included. And she is the author of King Hancock, The Radical Influence of a Moderate Founding Father, for which she received this year's nomination, and Boston in the American Revolution, A Town Versus an Empire. Brooke's newest book sounds fantastic. The title is Cocked and Boozy, An Intoxicating History of the American Revolution, and is now available for pre-order, releasing in June 2026. She's originally from San Diego, California, and has lived in Boston for many years. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
This is so great. Now, I was telling the folks in the intro that you have this tour company that I'm so sad I didn't know about last time I was in Boston, which is, it's been a while. Ye Old Tavern Tours, which sounds like a lot of fun. Tell us what it is and how you've done it for the last, 13 years?
Yeah, I started the company in 2013 because I wanted visitors to Boston to experience history in a fun and unique way. So we walk along Boston's storied Freedom Trail, which is 16 historic sites from the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. And we see 10 sites on the Freedom Trail, including the site of the Boston Massacre and where John Hancock and Paul Revere are buried. But then we stop at three historic taverns along the way to have a beer or cider in each. And Josh, this isn't just a gimmick. Taverns were integral to the American Revolution. And so when you're going into a historic tavern, you're experiencing history in a different way, but you are experiencing history.
That's fantastic. Do you all do like toasts to specific people? Like you get to Hancock's grave and you do a toast or something?
We always huzzah. That is a trademark of Ye Old Tavern Tours. We huzzah at each tavern and they always get more boisterous as we go, as you can imagine.
I can't imagine. I have a quick story to tell about that. I did, last time I was in Boston, I went to the Sam Adams thing. So this is not on the tour, I know, sir, the Ye Old Tavern Tour. And I went by myself, which was already embarrassing. And then I'm on this tour and in the, you know, at the end of it, they give you all the beers at the end of it. And okay, they kept passing the pitcher back to the table I was at. And the tour guide kept saying, I can't have any empty, all the pitchers have to be empty. And so I was, let's just say I had a really good time. Like I was in the wrong spot and drank all of it. But or the right spot for that matter,
because I imagine the right spot.
So it's beer and cider, and you know, that's what I think of when I think of what they would have drank back then. And one of the things that you're writing on right now, and I'm sure it's inspired by this experience with the tour company, is your new book. Remind me of the title.
Cocked and Boozy, An Intoxicating History of the American Revolution.
That's fantastic. And it's ready for pre-order and it comes out June 2026, right?
That's right. Yeah. So just in time for the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
So I want to eventually get to the book that you were nominated for, King Hancock. But this sounds, I can't pass up an opportunity to talk about this book because, I mean, I'm going to have to read it. What's the premise, right? So you already are saying, like, look, this isn't just a gimmick. These places where, these watering holes, if you will, they were important to the story of American history. And they have a part to play, not just in Boston, but other places as well. So where are you going with this?
The book's premise is that alcohol and taverns were important to the American Revolution. Taverns as were community centers in the 18th century. It's a place where people gathered, where they heard the latest news, where they talked politics, where they relaxed and played games, laughed and danced. And alcohol, then and now, loosens people up. And that can have positive and negative effects. And I explore both in the book.
Right.
But it's ripe for revolution. So when Parliament is passing what the colonists consider to be increasingly tyrannical laws or imposing these measures that they don't agree with, there's a built-in tavern and drinking culture in colonial America that helps ignite these revolutionary ideas. And so I explore that in the book and its effect on all 13 colonies. So typically my work with my tour company and my previous two books has really focused on Boston and somewhat outside of Boston. But this book is looking at the entire 13 colonies and the effect that drinking had on the revolution.
So, I mean, of course, it still has a huge impact on American politics today, having lived and worked in Washington myself at some point. So, having lived and worked in Washington before, I know that alcohol still plays a huge role in politics. That is for sure. And I'm wondering, when you went about to research this, Where do you go with it? What do you do? Like, how do you pinpoint these moments of where this culture had an impact?
I got a similar question from someone after I gave a talk recently. She said, "Where did you find these sources?" And I said, "They're in plain sight." These government officials, for example, during the Stamp Act riots or newspapers that the Stamp Act riots happened in 1765, mention alcohol. It's not as if alcohol was something to be ashamed of or that needed to be hid from the public. So in the Stamp Act riot, for example, you get a couple different places, newspapers and government officials are writing about this. For something like the First Continental Congress, where we see all of these delegates from 12 colonies getting together in Philadelphia, it's all there in their diaries. I mean, it's just right there where they say, met with so-and-so from this colony today, and we drank wine and claret and syllabub and punch. They list all of these drinks. So it's right there. And then sometimes I had to dig a little deeper, but if you're looking for it, it's there.
Did you say syllabub?
Yes. So, Josh, every chapter in Cocked and Boozy ends with a historic cocktail and then a modern version so you can make it today.
Okay.
And syllabub is one of the most unique cocktails. John Adams said that he tried syllabub when he was in Philadelphia. And it's essentially a boozy whipped cream. So you literally whip whipped cream. And then you add it to sherry or cider, and you usually eat it with a spoon. And it's delicious. I mean, it's very interesting and different than something you and I might normally have for dessert, but it's lovely.
It sounds like I shouldn't say this like on a show, but I definitely put Bailey's on ice cream before. It's not the same thing, but
I like that. It's a similar way to keep the dessert boozy. Yeah, why not?
I am not ashamed of that. But
nor so should you be, and nor was John Adams, and that's the point. It's right there in his diary. He mentioned so many different cocktails that he tried.
Was it a part of the? I mean, you're talking in particular about the culture of alcohol in among, you know, the founders and among the leaders who are making decisions related to politics, policy, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, et cetera. What about in the actual military? So in the revolution, you know, was it, I mean, I would think it'd be a problem to a point, but I mean, they're going to have rations of what, rum and Madeira, stuff like that, right?
Exactly right. So Madeira is far too expensive to be a ration, but rum was a ration for sure. And then so was beer and cider. And that's on both sides of the war. So both the British Army and Continental Army supplied alcohol. And yeah, it's a good question, Josh, because like I said, there's positive and negative effects when people drink. Usually positive when you are drinking just a few glasses, but it can turn quite negative if you have too much. And so we see accounts where alcohol was stolen from civilians, where civilians were frightened of drunken soldiers who would assault them or attempt to rob them. You see, George Washington, he's interesting because he understands that his soldiers need alcohol, that should be a part of the rations. He's frustrated that they can't get as much alcohol as they would like for his soldiers. But he also really wants to avoid those binges that can happen if a soldier was just left to their own devices. And so yeah, alcohol is a part of the war too. Famously, we think of Washington's crossing before the Battle of Trenton, and there's that iconic painting with Washington at the helm of the boat. And after the Continental Forces won the battle there, they then partied with this stolen wine or the spoils of war. And so we don't picture that party, but it's there. It happened.
Hey, Hessians, hold my beer. That's
Exactly. Hessians, we're going to take your beer.
that's
Thank
right.
you. Yeah.
You want to start a war? That'll
Yeah.
do it. Well, okay, we could go on forever with that. I'm getting thirsty. Speaking of, let me ask one more question about Washington. As I understand it, he himself was a significant distiller of whiskey, right?
That's right. So he built, he had the enslaved people who worked at Mount Vernon build a distillery, and they were the distillers. There were six enslaved men that were primarily distilling, but he had specifically hired a man from Scotland to oversee his farms, and that man had experience distilling and said to Washington, you know, you really could make good money if you opened a distillery. And Washington took his advice. And so at the end of his life, they were producing a lot of whiskey. And they also made rum too, and but whiskey was the primary spirit.
Interesting, interesting. That makes me feel I'm just get more patriotic every time I go to the tavern, right? That'd be it's
You
one
can go
way
to
to think.
they've reconstructed the distillery at Mount Vernon. It's lovely to go down there.
All right, well, I want to talk about your book on John Hancock. It was nominated for our Herbert J. Storing Prize, and the title is King Hancock: The Radical Influence of a Moderate Founding Father. Now, you've written, I think, a very readable and enjoyable, well-done biography of an American who most other Americans only know by his signature. I may have already answered the question by saying that, but why did Brooke write this book in particular on Hancock?
By the way, for the kind words about the book, and I was thrilled to be nominated for the prize. One of the questions I get the most on my tour is about John Hancock, because I think many visitors to Boston are surprised that John Hancock lived in Boston. They may maybe just sort of think of him like amorphously living somewhere in the 13 colonies, but not specifically in Boston. And so the last book that had been written about him was by a scholar was 40 years earlier. And so I thought, let's take a new look at him. And he's this eminently fascinating person. We think of him for this signature, but he was this man of contradictions. And so that was really interesting and fun to explore as a historian.
When researching the book, what do you think surprised you the most, when doing the digging?
So this relates to what we were just talking about and the role of alcohol. But what surprised me so much is how many people talked about Hancock being so personable. And you don't hear people say that about Thomas Jefferson, George
No.
Washington. You rarely hear that. But you would hear different accounts. So a newspaper might account say this, a letter might say this. But Hancock was able to build this tremendous popularity in Massachusetts because I argue because he was a man of the people. Despite being the wealthiest man in the colony, he had a real gift for connecting with people. So number one, that's surprising because we very rarely hear anyone at this time being good at retail politics, at shaking hands and things like that. But Hancock was great at that. And number two is he often used alcohol to help with that. So one of the ways that he built popularity was through hosting parties or picking up the tab at a tavern or sponsoring wine. When the Stamp Act was repealed in 1766, he rolls out a cask of Madeira, Josh. And so this would be the first time that some people would be tasting this very expensive drink. And then he would go around and chat with the people about this victory of the Stamp Act repeal. So he's this really interesting I was interested in him on his face. But then as you asked, the more I researched, the more I found that he was practicing a very different kind of politics, in some ways pretty modern style politics than what others at the time were.
There's so many interesting points in this book, and it gives a background about the history of Boston, about Massachusetts, and just the economy of the time, of course, which he's very involved in. I wanted to, we can't go through the whole book, obviously, but I thought I'd focus on three particular moments or themes that I and other reviewers found particularly interesting in Hancock's life story. And we'll try and get to all three. We'll just see how what time allows. But the first one is, you argue that Hancock was critical to maintaining America's alliance with the French during the Revolution. That was a big part. Obviously, Benjamin Franklin secures it, but Hancock keeps it going. What did you mean by that? How do you tell us where you're going with that?
The alliance with France, when we look back 250 years later, we think, of course, we'll take whatever help we can get. But in fact, what's so interesting, Josh, is just the decade before the war broke out, so in the 1750s and early 1760s, the colonists fought alongside British troops against French forces. Right. And so now here in the late 1770s, the colonists, or now the United States after declaring independence, say, no, now we're going to fight alongside the French against the British. And it makes sense to us in hindsight, but for people there, they had these long-standing prejudices against the French. One, because of these wars, but two, particularly in Massachusetts, many French inhabitants were Catholic, and many inhabitants, the majority of inhabitants in Massachusetts, were Protestants. And so there was even just this religious prejudice against the French. So when the French arrive, they don't make this great splash. They don't help in this critical battle that could happen in Newport, Rhode Island. And they sail back to Boston and sort of abandoning thousands of New England soldiers. So this is their first arrival, saying, yeah, we're going to be here to help. We'll bring our Navy. And in fact, they just leave Newport and go back to Boston. And George Washington was nervous that this could hurt that the way that Massachusetts would treat France. The French would hurt the alliance. Mm-hmm. And it was made worse because a French officer is killed in Boston in this scuffle on the street. And so Washington says, we really need to make big efforts to welcome them. And then that's what Hancock does best. He is able to entertain, and he entertains lavishly.
And so he basically, he parties them into staying in the war, essentially.
Yeah, and he's the perfect man to do it. he's about as aristocratic as someone in the colonies can be. Of course, we don't have an aristocracy, but he's as close as it comes, with his fine clothing and his fine home and filled with rich details that the French officers would appreciate. And so he opens up his home, essentially an open house, to the French. And this wasn't, as we sort of talked about earlier, this wasn't the first time he did this. He loved throwing parties. He loved hosting as a way to bring people together. And so by offering such spectacular hospitality, the French said, hey, these people aren't that bad, and stuck around.
That's fantastic. The religious side of it, for us at the Ciceronian Society, we know historically that's always been a thing, the Protestant Catholic type thing. But the Ciceronian Society is an organization mostly entirely of Christians, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox. And it's so bizarre to me after experiencing our conferences, because it's the Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox that drink together. That's how we make it work. Of course, the Baptists are there to drive us home because they don't, you know, they don't drink. But I'm an Anglican, a bunch of other Catholics. So it's becoming more and more patriotic now.
Josh, what you're saying is what happened is when people drink together, not in excess, but right. drink together. Yeah, it can break down walls. You can find common ground. I mean, this is picking up on all of what we've talked about in this conversation. And mm-hmm. that's what happens here. Paul Revere is half French. And he said, I was prejudiced against France, but that dissolved away. Once you get to know people, especially through drink or a party, you might feel more akin to them. And so what you're describing at your conference is a tale as old as time.
I love it. The second moment or piece in your book about Hancock that I thought was particularly important was the Shays Rebellion. So, classic teaching of the American Constitutional Convention and what inspires it. It's not the only thing, but it's a big part, right? Shays Rebellion in Massachusetts alerts the American elites, like, look, the Articles of Confederation are not working. We need to do something about this. They call the Constitutional Convention. Hancock plays a role in making sure this doesn't get out of hand, right?
Shays Rebellion, it's not just Shays Rebellion.
Right.
It's the reaction that happens in Massachusetts because, mm-hmm. so you're exactly right. Shays Rebellion is this flashpoint because people see ordinary farmers actually affecting change. They are shutting down courts because of the pressure that they're putting on judges and the community. But after Shays Rebellion, when it gets shut down by Governor James, sort of in sort of a belligerent way, maybe in a heavy-handed way, what happens is Bowdoin gets voted out of office. He's the first incumbent governor to lose his spot, and he loses it to John Hancock. And other legislators who sided with Bowdoin get voted out. And that was particularly scary. So one, we have ordinary people affecting change with protests, and then we have them affecting change at the ballot box. And that was really scary to people who said this, we can't have, this is a lot of influence that these people are having. We need a stronger federal government. We need a federal government to oversee this. So, Hancock was really important though, because when he was elected governor, he sees, as he often could, that what Massachusetts needed wasn't to punish these, insurgents that participated in Shays Rebellion, but that the state needed healing. And so he pardoned almost all of them. And that sort of calmed the tension down in Massachusetts. And, but then yes, it also is one of the things that leads to the Constitutional Convention.
How long was Hancock governor of Massachusetts?
He was governor. He was the first elected governor in 1780. And he serves, so it's 1 year terms, Josh. That's what's sort of confusing is he serves several terms. And then he decides in the middle of his term to bow out and retire. And then the next election is when James Bowdoin gets elected. And Bowdoin serves, has this debacle with Shays Rebellion, and then Hancock comes back in. And Hancock served until 1793 when he dies in office.
Moving on then to the Constitutional Convention, we have this third moment that I think is especially prescient and part of Hancock's legacy is during the ratification debates. You know, one of the things that modern Americans don't realize is there was no guarantee this Constitution was going to get passed. Yes, there were these crises and things were not going really well economically. There were threats internationally. There was a lot of It was a mess, and even some of the anti-federalists were saying, "Look, the articles aren't working. Right? We need to do something." But there was no guarantee this ratification was going to work, or that Hancock was going to support it. Right? In particular, given his influence in Massachusetts. So, what role does he play in Massachusetts's ratification of the Constitution?
Everything you said, Josh, I agree with. Hancock doesn't sit on the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He's busy governing in Massachusetts. And at the time, and this is going to sound strange, but state business was considered more important than this sort of unknown constitutional convention happening in Philadelphia. So Hancock felt like he was in this position of power, which he was by being governor of one of the most powerful states in the 13. So when the Constitution, excuse me, is sent to the states for approval, they don't want it put to a vote. They want it, the Constitutional Convention says that 9 states need to ratify, and it will be ratified by special conventions, statewide conventions. And the Federalists, that is those who supported the Constitution, they get some easy wins right away. A few states just unanimously ratify. And then Pennsylvania is sort of this warning sign because Pennsylvania ratifies, but a third of the delegates vote against it. And so now the Federalists are getting a little bit nervous because when it comes to Massachusetts has so much revolutionary clout that they built from the 1760s and 1770s that they suspected if Massachusetts didn't ratify, that New Hampshire wouldn't either, and New York might not either. And in fact, New Hampshire was postponing their convention until Massachusetts could hold theirs. And this is a concern that James Madison and George Washington are discussing. So this isn't a historian looking back and saying, oh, this is probably what was happening. This was happening in real time. This concern that if Massachusetts didn't go, other states, you wouldn't get to 9. And so on the Constitutional Convention begins, Hancock is named the president of the Constitutional Convention. He is sick for much of the convention and doesn't attend. But it's widely considered, we don't have his thoughts on this, but it's widely considered that he would have voted against the Constitution. And if you want, we can talk about why that would be.
Yeah, well,
But
can you maybe stop for a second there and just why would he have why do they think he would have voted against it?
because he's in a really good position. He's the governor of one of these 13 states. So he's one of the 13 most powerful people in the country. And if you had a central national government, you're being the governor is likely going to be less important. We don't know what the Constitution would say, but it would likely be less important. And he's concerned that this national government would then take away power from the states and from him as a governor. And he called states republics, that they were their own individual republic. And he said they have their own religions, they have their own climates, their own economies. He recognized that Massachusetts, on its face, maybe doesn't share that many similarities with South Carolina, for example, Pennsylvania, for another example. And so to have this national government, he worried, would dilute the concerns of Massachusetts.
Yeah, and so then it got, comes to the ratification, and it seems like he surprises everyone and says, "Look, and he doesn't exactly say yes, right? He finds his own middle way. How does he go about endorsing but not endorsing it?"
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Constitutional Convention had said you must ratify it, yes, or decline it, no. But there can be no changes. And every state before Massachusetts, and there had been 6 that had ratified before, or excuse me, 5 that had ratified before, all just approved. But the Federalists lobbied Hancock and said you can propose changes because they suspected, probably rightfully, that if Hancock voted against it, it wouldn't get enough votes. And so they said, you can propose amendments. And that's exactly what Hancock does, which is what you're talking about. He threads this needle. So he makes this speech on the day the vote's going to happen, and he says, I'm supporting it, but with these amendments. And then every state that ratified thereafter also proposed amendments. And those eventually became over 100 amendments that were sent to Congress, but they eventually became the 10 Bill of Rights that we know. And so Hancock's legacy of the Constitution is it lies with some of the most cherished parts of the Constitution are the Bill of Rights. And that came not from the supporters of the Constitution, but the people who had concerns about it.
Right. Right. In many ways, he's representative of that revolutionary spirit. We want these rights. We want the Bill of Rights to be in there. Of course, Massachusetts will ratify it. Then we got Rhode Island, just south of there. They're going to hold out forever, right? I mean,
This is one of the things that I try to write about in my books, is trying to remove our 21st century ideas, which can be very difficult, of course.
Yeah.
But the idea, like you said, the Constitution, you might think today, oh, of course it's going to be ratified, done and done. It's been the law of the land for 240 years. But at the time, people were really concerned. Americans were very concerned about this, and they have good reason to, if you think about it. They had just spent 8 years fighting this distant, in their view, tyrannical government that was making decisions for them that wasn't based on their own interests. It was based on this central power. And so then, for some Americans, they say, we don't want to swap our independent state governments for some distant government that doesn't care as much about our individual needs. So Rhode Island, for example, like you said, Rhode Island doesn't participate in the Constitutional Convention. They said no delegates, and then they don't approve until 1790. So it wasn't in real time. It was very uncertain if it was going to be ratified. And it wasn't, for example, by Rhode Island until after it had been ratified for the other states.
Well, I think it's important too. This award that you're nominated for, the Herbert Storing Prize. Storing, one of the things he's famous for is bringing back and emphasizing the importance of the Anti-Federalists. Now, he's not sympathetic in the sense that he's sympathetic to the Constitution, but one of the things he talks about, and I recommend to our listeners his work on this, is that you really can't understand the Constitution without reading and appreciating these, genuine, thoughtful, patriotic Americans who said, we don't want this. Their opposition shaped the Constitution just as much as those who supported, like the Federalists. And I think James Madison would agree with that assessment as well. I think they had legitimate questions and concerns, and they had a huge impact. Hancock is certainly, I don't know if we'd go so far as to call Hancock a anti-Federalist, would we?
No,
or, no. Somewhere in between, right?
Yeah. And Hancock, one of the reasons he's, as I told you, he stayed popular throughout his life. And one of the ways he did that was by not always landing on a side strongly, a political side. He really took his time deliberating, but he would be much more leaning towards anti-Federalist. While he does eventually certainly vote with Federalists, those amendments are signify his big concerns. And so, like you're saying, they're evaluating anti-Federalists as thoughtful people with real concerns, legitimate concerns that stem from the same American Revolution that the Federalists had just participated in. They're interpreting it in a different way, is really important. And Hancock gave me the opportunity to do that.
That's great.
Looking at Hancock.
One last question then before we close here. I'd like you to just reflect briefly on why you think, you're just thinking about the end of Hancock's life and his legacy after this, because Hancock fits in this category of founders where a lot of Americans have heard his name, but almost no one, I mean, we started with this question, right? Almost no one knows anything about him. We grow up in learning about John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. All that's great. I'm not discouraging that. But there's these, the bench, right? The founder's bench, if you will.
Yeah, second tier. You can say it, Josh.
Second tier. I'm not, and again, I'm not dissing them. I think it's interesting. Like, what happened here? Why did people like, focus on Hancock, but I think we could bring up others like John Jay and James Wilson, John Dickinson, others where like these people were really, really important. But most Americans don't even know who they are. What do you think happened there? Was it early on or was it a later development of forgetting them?
Interestingly, Hancock was known for his signature in his life. So he was known for the Declaration of Independence, like not the signature itself, but him being the one to authorize it in his lifetime. That had sort of crystallized while he was there, that significant point in his political life. And then it's interesting because when the Declaration of Independence that we think of today with all of the signatures, the 56 signatures, the American public didn't see that until the late 18 teens into the 1820s. There was only one copy, and they never made a copy of the copy. And so in the 1820s, and this is right around the 50 year of the Declaration of Independence, when Americans see this signature, that solidifies Hancock's, in some ways, legacy, or starts to build it, I should say, rather than solidifies it. He'd already been known for Declaration of Independence, and now here he has this larger signature than everyone else's. It's also beautiful penmanship, and it's right there in the center. And it's in the center because he was the president of the Second Continental Congress, but people don't need to know that. They just look at it and they think, wow, look at this bold stance this guy took. And that's when that legacy of the myth that when asked why he signed the declaration so big, John Hancock said, so that King George III could see it without his spectacles, which didn't happen. But that myth starts developing at this time. So in some ways, it was just like that's all he needed to be known for was this big signature, and that just became it.
I forgot to ask you at the beginning, the title of the book is King Hancock. Why is he called King Hancock?
Oh, that's one of my favorite things. So King Hancock was an insult initially from British officers who were stationed in Boston in 1774, and they held captive this Bostonian, and they demanded to know from him who ordered the Boston Tea Party. And this guy says, nobody. And the British officer yells, you're a damned liar. It was King Hancock and the damned Sons of Liberty. And this is great. This is the first time we see this in the historical record, at least that I or others have found. But it's an insult. They're saying the best you colonists can do for your king is this guy, John Hancock. The real monarch sits in London. But then the most remarkable thing happens. Less than a year later, after the battles of Lexington and Concord, on April 19th, 1775, when British troops are retreating from Concord back to Boston, 20 miles, they are being fired on by colonists from over 20 towns who came out to fight the British. They are being shot at from behind trees and inside homes. So this retreat's already 20 miles. They're being fired on by people they can't see, but they can hear these colonists cry out, King Hancock forever. So what had been this insult was appropriated into a literal battle cry on the day the Revolutionary War began. And that is saying something. I mean, it's so powerful the way this nickname had been reused and to signify their loyalty to someone right here in Massachusetts. Josh, it also portrays a sense of humor. It shows Hancock's vast popularity, not just in Boston, but in the Massachusetts countryside. And then that name continues to come up. That nickname, King Hancock, continues to be used throughout the 1770s and 80s.
That's fantastic. Well, Brooke, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I really enjoyed your book. I'm glad we could celebrate it with this nomination. And I definitely want to encourage our listeners to, next time you're in Boston, look up Ye Olde Tavern Tours. That sounds like so much fun. I definitely hope to do that in the near future. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. We'd love to see your listeners, but most of all, I just really appreciate your fine questions here and kind words about the book.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you know of a recent book written about the American founding era, please consider nominating it for our 2027 Herbert J. Storing Prize. Nominations are due September 1st. More information can be found via a link in the show notes. And if you like history and beer and enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll also be having our first ever fall symposium in Holland, Michigan in October of this year. Be sure to keep an eye out for more information soon. Oh, and make sure you check out our other podcast, which involves us reading through Cicero's most famous work, On Duties, De Officiis, and our commentary on it. We hope you can enjoy that. It is released every Wednesday. Please rate and review this and that other podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.